This is Tarello Institute for Legal Philosophy's podcast. Hello and welcome back with our new session of our cycle of meeting our visitors in this podcast of the Tarello Institute. Here we are with our recent visitor from Poland, David Wunigowski.
Great.
I'm so sorry for the pronunciation. You can present yourself with a nicer pronunciation, the real pronunciation of your name. Welcome to the Institute. How are you?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. My name is David Wunigowski, as you said. Great. Yes, I'm a visitor here this week within this Erasmus program, you know, framework for staff, let's say. So I'm a Polish legal philosopher. You see, I have to mention nationality to, know, to make people know who I am, where I come from. I'm a Polish legal philosopher, but based in Eastern Finland. So, if I can say something about my education, for example, or career. So I studied at Nicolaus Copernicus University in Toruń. So it's north central Poland. And I did my master's there in criminal law. Then I moved to legal theory. I worked with my academic master, Professor Wiesław Lang. He died 10 years ago. Then also with Professor Lech Morawski, also quite known for different reasons, like academic and political ones. He also died like 6 years ago. There was the meeting actually in Lisbon, if I were. So my academic masters are dead. Life will feel.
Conversation.
But with Lang, well, my PhD was about enforcement of morality by law. So, and my approach was both theoretical, and practical. So it was like discussion what law is, what morality is, what are relations. Then I, of course, discussed the debate between Devin and Hart and so on. I was interested in many different things like liberalism, Mill, and so on. And then the second part of this research in PhD was much more practical. So I studied different cases like abortion, one chapter, 50 pages, euthanasia, another chapter, pornography, prostitution, human fertilization, and so on, divorce, and so on, many different. And my methodology in this practical part was like, I was trying to find out pros and cons legalization, for example, of abortion, of euthanasia. And of course, I had some idea that was quite liberal idea at that time about interference of law into morality. English people speak enforcement of morality by law. I use this concept interference of law into the field of morality, but it's the same almost. So that was PhD, like law and morality, enforcement of morality by law. Why did I study that? I was interested in morally and socially controversial cases. And I was also interested in this question whether we can incorporate to some extent, or whether generally we can incorporate perfectionist ethical principles or rules to a given legal system, like prohibition of abortion or limitation of, abortion as a, let's say, freedom of choice, such questions. So that was my PhD. So I did my PhD also at Nicolaus Copernicus University. And then I worked in Poland in holding of banking schools. Yes, I was even a vice dean of Faculty of Finance and Management. So I moved to another area, law, morality and economy. And then I started my postdoctoral research when I was just tired by this Polish banking stuff. I started my postdoctoral research at the University of Eastern Finland 10 years ago in the School of Law. And my project was the financial crisis. That was this crisis, you know, that started in 2007 as an axiological crisis. The crisis of law, the crisis of morality.
Okay.
Like, for example, whether we had not too many regulations. That was deregulation, and that was the problem. And what about corporate governance and business ethics in companies? You know, misinformation, fraud, and so on as rules of behavior. So something like official and unofficial axiology, I called that like that. So I was interested how corporations work, why this crisis started. A lack of regulation, a lack of supervision over banking sectors, insurance companies, and so on. On the other hand, how people behaved in corporations, what ethics was, you know, a kind of internalized ethics or this real ethics behavior, I would say. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we can place something in our codes of ethics and we can do something different. And I was interested in this gap between both, let's say, kinds of ethics or morality.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing something like that. But when I was in Finland, you know, this it's one of the five Nordic countries.
Yeah.
So I started to be interested in another topic. So in indigenous rights.
Oh.
Yeah. And in 20, because there are the Sami people, the Aboriginal people living in northern Scandinavia and Russian Kola Peninsula. So, and I was interested in recognition of indigenous rights, like right to self-determination, linguistic rights, cultural rights, land rights, and so on. So I started, but before I had been interested also in legal pluralism when I had been in Poland still. So I had some theoretical framework.
Yeah.
Legal pluralism. And I did bring this theoretical framework of legal pluralism to study, you know, these indigenous rights in the Nordic countries.
Mm-hmm.
So in the beginning, people did not understand me, what I'm talking about, what's legal pluralism and how to, you know, implement or apply this theory to the Nordic countries. But in fact, it's very easy because it's about giving more political and cultural power to indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
Because what I've noticed, there are some legal systems or orders, like Francesco Viola says, that are overlapping, and there is no rule of recognition which would say to us which, you know, system is higher or better.
Yeah.
So we have to decide in terms of our loyalty, which rules I would like to follow. Yes,
mm-hmm.
And for indigenous peoples, it is not so clear. Which rules? Of course, they appreciate their indigenous customary rules, for example, concerning where they should herd reindeer. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But according to state law, the rule might be different. Yeah, and then there is some tension. For example, if Finland forbids fishing in Tana River, it's the biggest salmon river in the north. But according to customary law of the Sami people, it is allowed because it had been allowed since the times immemorial. So then we have a problem of tension of two different legal systems. So I was interested like that. In 2015, at the University of the Arctic, it is a network of different universities in the north, let's say even in America, there are some universities which are in this group. So we established a subgroup of philosophy of law in the Arctic. And I was a leader of this, and I'm still a leader of this subgroup of philosophy of law in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was developing this discipline, philosophy of law in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
And a year ago at the University of Lapland, I was granted a docentship, this academic title, in the field of philosophy of law in the Arctic.
Oh.
Probably it's the first and only one in the world.
So unique.
Yeah. And for me, there are two questions here. If we speak about philosophy of law in the Arctic,
mm-hmm.
what is indigenous law from our Western perspective,
yes,
from the perspective of Western philosophy of law,
mm-hmm.
because it's, you know, perception is different here. And what is law for indigenous people?
Mm-hmm.
They think about law, whether law is much more related to custom, tradition, cosmology even,
mm-hmm.
because maybe there is no such clear separation like in this Western tradition, like we try to separate law, morality, religion, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my way, this is where, of course, there are many things I have skipped, but maybe... You speak later.
No, maybe yes, but just a question about this last research interest that you are trying,
yeah.
I think, that you developed in this moment. Have you considered the developments on legal pluralism, especially in Latin America and South America, for example,
mm-hmm.
Ecuador, Bolivia,
mm-hmm.
which are now, especially Bolivia, are having this pluralist state?
Yes. Yes, I have heard about this. This is somehow inspiring for me. And this is quite interesting, a kind of paradox that South America might be a kind of pattern for other countries supposedly to be very human rights oriented countries. Like Nordic countries are, you know, supposed to be very human rights oriented countries, but they have problem with recognition of indigenous rights.
Mm-hmm.
And in Bolivia, they are better in this recognition. Mm-hmm. In Canada, they are better, even in America. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In the Nordic countries, I think there are problems because we speak about welfare states, about egalitarian countries, mm-hmm. in which there are no exclusive rights for given, you know, special groups. Yeah.
Okay.
So how to say, for example, that in a part of our territory, there are people with special rights. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And other people are just excluded. Yeah. They can't fish. They can't herd reindeer and so on. So for Finns, this is just against egalitarianism. Yeah, as a political philosophy they are based on. So this example is quite interesting. And I think that I will also have some examples maybe from other South American countries, because a year ago, I started also to teach part-time at the University of Guyana,
mm-hmm.
Formerly British,
yeah.
And they have also indigenous peoples, and there are also problems there with recognition of their rights.
Yeah.
Of course, Peru, Bolivia, they are better, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I will have a look also at this South American experience, and maybe I will bring some ideas, patterns to the North, which is supposed to be better, let's say, or, you know, more civilizational, you know. People think like that. People have some stereotypes, prejudices, mm-hmm. that we live in utopian countries because we are Nordic, for example, we are better developed. To some extent, it's true. There is no poverty, for example, yeah? But
mm-hmm.
this does not mean that there are no problems. There are problems with indigenous peoples, with recognition of their rights. There are many other problems like racism in the job market and so on. So it's I don't like, you know, this kind of making a utopia that, you know, there are some countries which are like ideal. There are no such countries, or
mm-hmm.
you know, less or better, but the problems are everywhere. And this paradox that we can take some pattern from Bolivia, for example, yeah,
mm-hmm.
to the north, to the Nordic countries. Yeah, but if we speak about this research, for example, this Arctic research or legal philosophical research about the Arctic. This is, I think, my last step, because my research interests are quite diverse.
Mm-hmm.
If you would like to talk about that.
No, absolutely. This is your interview, so you can talk about whatever.
Yeah, so my research interests are like, I'm interested in law and morality and in law plus everything.
Mm-hmm.
So law, anthropology, law culture, law religion, law language. Yeah. So some law politics and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I conduct cross-disciplinary and multidisciplinary research. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not only related to law itself or to legal science, let's say. And I would split my development of legal ideas into four periods. So the first period of my development of legal ideas was about law and morality, I would say. So I was interested in that,
mm-hmm.
and I developed quite a liberal attitude to law in terms of more, you know, I would say morality, concrete provisions. So I supported quite liberal theory of law, like Dworkin, for example. So I was against conservative legal regulations concerning abortion or euthanasia. So
mm-hmm.
I was developing this idea that if we make such prohibitions, then we interfere by law into our morality,
mm-hmm.
because we try to incorporate some perfectionist ethical rules, values,
mm-hmm.
principles, often taken from religions like Catholicism. So I was just criticizing that this is against this liberal framework we
mm-hmm.
live in. And this is mostly period related to my PhD, so like in 2000s. So that was this first period of my career or development of my ideas, quite liberal theory of law.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second period I would call analytical period,
mm-hmm.
because I was very much interested in analytical philosophy of law, especially in ordinary language philosophy. So in my bag, I always had the Tractatus of Wittgenstein, and I was working with that everywhere. I took part in many seminars in Cambridge, in Oxford, you know, related to this. I'm still taking part in Zoom meetings of Moral Sciences Club in Cambridge every week. Maybe with not such interest like it was before, but I was very much interested in Wittgenstein, and then of course John Langshaw, Austin, and Weizmann, and so on. So this kind of stuff I was interested in. So because I wanted to find out precision in language, and in legal, and to make me understand what legal interpretation is, and how to make legal interpretation better. Where the question is, what I should speak and when I should be silent. That was taken from Wittgenstein, in fact. Of course, his considerations are more general. For example, we can't speak about religion and so on because there is no proof and so on. But I wanted to take this theory of Wittgenstein to law. So Dennis Patterson and so on, they were my heroes that time. Then this analytical legal philosophy was somehow left. But on the way, I met great people, philosophers like Jane Hill or Matthew Kramer and so on. But then I left this analytical philosophy, let's say, and then I moved to the third period, I would call like conservative mystical. So I was interested in relations between, it was in 2010s, relations between law, metaphysics, law, morality, religion, something deeper, you know. Because law is just a technical tool. It is only a tool to regulate behavior, to solve disputes, to what else? To redistribute wealth, that's all. What is it? So then I was interested in deeper justifications, like whether there is any sense of law which is deeper. And then, well, it was not so long ago. We published with Alberto Puppo 3 years ago, something like that, a book in Springer, Why Religion? A Critical Philosophy of Law, Peace and God. So we use different approaches, different people were invited to this project, Catholics, Muslims, agnostics, atheists, but seeking something deeper, let's say. So that was interesting. The period I am in now, I would call
this moment
pluralistic.
Pluralistic
phase of everything. So I see that world is diverse, sophisticated. Of course, I'm in favor of human rights.
Yes.
So, but I understand that human rights are interpreted differently in different countries. But for me, the border is dignity. So if I see, for example, women being beaten in Iran for wearing niqab or hijab badly, so this is against humanity, against the dignity and humanity, of course. So I understand that in some countries, Sharia law, for example, is implemented for cultural reasons, historical reasons, and so on. Religion is a part of culture. Okay, there is no distinction between private public life, religion and law. But even there, I think that there are some clear violations of those human rights we think that they are universal. But in fact, human rights are not so universal as we think they are, because they are not ahistorical. They were invented in a given historical, philosophical context and environment, which is Western political philosophy. Of course, and then we just exported that. Of course, these ideas are great, because after the Second World War, we remind ourselves of the dignity of the people, that we are equal in our dignity. So this is important. But I think that there are still differences between different countries, different regions. And as a scholar, I'm not to blame. I am to understand why there are differences, how people behave, why they behave as they behave, why they have such rules or different rules. I don't believe that we are able to build, for example, something like the world government with one uniform legal order. Of course, we can have some patterns, and we should go to some universal norms to meet some ideal. But as countries, we will meet this ideal in different ways, always, because there are so many differences, cultural differences between us. So I believe in legal pluralism much more. In global legal pluralism, but when we go to a given country or a given social area, I believe also in legal pluralism that there are competing legal orders. Like, for example, there is canon law, there is state law. And then, for example, if I'm a doctor, and I'm a Catholic or, devout Catholic, and I don't want to commit, carry out an abortion, because what is more important, canon law, yeah, even if it's not state law, and there is state law which is quite permissive, for example, in the field of abortion, let's say in Italy, but doctor says no, I don't want, yeah. So somebody can say, okay, let's change profession. Yeah? Something like that. No, this is my, how this is called, clause of conscience, or, you know. Conscious objection. Yes. So I use this. I don't know whether this in Italy, I don't remember, but in Poland it is like that.
It is like that.
Yeah, it's also a cultural Catholic country, you know, historically. So such, well, and you see, in law we see some historical, traditional religious institutions, because this comes from religion directly, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in this historical, traditional, let's say, approach to law. For example, when I live in, let's say, in the north, in the high north, I see many constitutions, like in Norway, like in Denmark. In the Denmark constitution, it reads that the king must be a member of the National Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether he is a believer or not. He must be a member, because Lutheranism is supported by the state. Of course, there is a lot of freedom of religion. Yeah?
Yeah.
They are very progressive liberal people. But on the other hand, Lutheranism is a part of constitutional tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to reject that, because it's part of their identity. Yeah. Yeah. So the same in Norway. A half the members of the state council must be members of the National Lutheran Church. The same. It's the same. And why? Because sometimes we take things for granted. We don't think about, you know, the justification of such provisions. There must have been such justification when, for example, this constitution was passed in the 19th century. Of course, there was no strict division between state and religion, and this Lutheranism was visible in law, in state law, in constitutional law. To me, in such countries, Lutheranism is still visible in behavior of people,
mm-hmm.
in modesty, it's in such values, in hard job, not complaining, yeah, modesty and limiting expression, for example. This comes directly from Lutheranism to me. And of course, you know, landscape is gray, very short days.
Of course, and this last thing into consideration, maybe you came here to the Trello Institute because of the legal
landscape.
No, what were the reasons why you came here for doing your research study?
Yeah, so Trello Institute of Legal Philosophy is famous. It's one of the best, one of the best institutes of legal philosophy in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I think that comparable to or with Oxford or Cambridge ones or New York and so on. So this very famous. The problem was I knew people from the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah, LA, but I never met them in person.
Yeah.
So even if they participated in the same conferences, but this IFAWER conference, as you know, includes hundreds of people. So,
mm-hmm.
For example, Andrei Kristan, or, you know, Comanducci, for example. He's now retired, Professor Comanducci.
Yeah, he's emeritus.
Yes, he's emeritus. So I met those people, for example, in Alicante, like in 2015, there was a seminar, Franco-Italiano, you know, Spanish.
Yeah, the inferior seminars, yes, exactly.
Organized by Manuel Atienza, people there. So
I think that you are referring to the iLatina, maybe, because there are two different seminars, like the iLatina, which is this big Latin thing, and then the French, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish.
It was this smaller one, but smaller, like
that is organized. Yeah, it was, I think, in Alicante, but
in 2015 it was.
Yes.
In Girona.
Yes, exactly. But it's organized by especially the people from, for example, Genoa. Yes.
Coordinated, let's say, by Alicante.
No, because I think that in the same year there was this iLatina also.
Yeah. I remember that they said if you would like to participate in a bigger congress.
Bigger.
Yeah, Latin, exactly. Really Latin. Yeah, I remember also. And then I met those people, but like Professor Comanducci and also Professor Grabowski from Poland said to me, you have to talk to Professor Comanducci because he's famous in this environment, which is, Mediterranean environment, Mediterranean legal theory, mm-hmm. let's say. Yeah, that was also quite interesting for me to meet people from this, let's say, Mediterranean Latin legal culture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, much to speak about, but I think that this culture develops somehow in a different way, but is some, you know, inspired a bit by Anglo-Saxon philosophy of law, of course, like Dworkin. But Latin people would like to be a bit separated from this Anglo-Saxon philosophy. So, for example, I found such idea that we, for example, Spanish legal philosophers, we study Dworkin, but they don't study us. Yeah, something like that. Or we have to speak English with them. They don't speak Spanish to us. You know, something like that with us. So this kind of cultural difference or linguistic difference, or, you know, I think that there are such differences that, for example, English, American or British legal philosophers, they are not so much interested in legal theories coming from France, Italy, Spain, Poland, and so on, or, you know, German, maybe German a bit, but I don't tell you the name, but I was talking with one of the prominent Anglo-Saxon, let's say, legal philosophers, and I asked, do you know who Leon Petrzyński was?
Yeah.
The founding father of psychological theory of law. I have no idea. I don't know. Yeah, so this, like, they don't, well, we live like in our legal theories,
yeah.
Like in Central Europe, we must study, you know, German legal philosophers or even Italian or Spanish, like Bobbio and so on. But English or British or American legal philosophers, they are not so much interested. They are not so much interested in our legal theories. And I found this when I also was talking to Spanish or Italian legal philosophers, that they think the same, that there is a huge gap between us. Maybe one exception is Professor John Finnis. He knows who Leon Petrzyński is, for example.
Yeah.
He speaks many languages. But this is quite rare, exceptional, I would say. But that was something interesting. I found myself as a person who can speak to legal philosophers from different countries, like Brazil, like Italy, that we are interested in very similar things also, like analytic legal philosophy and so on. Because I see that, in fact, this Latin legal philosophy is interested in Wittgenstein, yeah? But they want to follow their own way, yeah? And they develop that very deeply. But I think that it's worth cooperation, yeah? So that's why I like also to be here to talk to people who are like from Argentina, like you,
yeah,
Italy, Spain, Colombia,
yeah,
so many different countries. So this is quite interesting for me, you know.
It is.
And it's sunny.
Yes.
It's a wonderful city. I visited many churches. I love, you know, this architecture is very diverse here. It's Gothic, Neo-Gothic, and Renaissance, Gothic. Baroque.
Yeah, everything is included in the city. Well, thank you very much for the interview, and thank you very much for coming. And I hope that in these last days of your stay, you are going to get to know more of the city and then to conclude your stay in the best way possible.
Thank you very much also. Yeah, it was very nice to meet you. Thank you very much.